Welcome to another episode of the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. I'm your host, Richie Billing, and today I'm delighted to welcome back Dr. N. Burke, our resident sociologist, who's come to share their wisdom on villains and deviant characters and how sociological influences could shape their behavior. It was a truly fascinating chat, just like our first one, and it complements very well our recent episode on the psychology of villains and heroes. I got so many ideas from chatting with N, and I'm sure you will do too. But before we dive in, just a few quick reminders. First of all, if you haven't already done so, be sure to subscribe or follow the show. And that's just to make sure you don't miss any future episodes. Our episodes are pretty regular, every 2 weeks. And you never know, life's busy, you might miss one. So if you follow us, you'll make sure that will never happen. If you really do like listening to the show, one way that you can support us is by leaving us a quick review or rating, particularly on Spotify. The Spotify mobile app now lets you rate your favorite shows out of 5 stars. So a lot of people have given us ratings so far, and I'm very grateful for that. So thank you very much. And if you're looking to join a community of writers, maybe to get feedback on some stories that you've written or some chapters of a novel, then join our writing group. We're active on Discord and Facebook, and it's the perfect place to discuss ideas, meet like-minded people, and ultimately get feedback on your stories. And that feedback, I know from experience and from working with a lot of other writers, that the feedback is a great way to take your writing to a whole new level. And if you are keen to keep on learning beyond what you listen to on this show, check out our Patreon page. I've been adding loads of new things in the last few weeks, and it's becoming quite active. So as well as regular content, blog posts that you can only find on Patreon, there are 3 new tiers, extra incentives added to existing ones, and you can also nab a limited edition Toolshed t-shirt, which I'm quite happy with the design, and it's got a pretty cool slogan on it as well, which regular listeners you'll know that slogan well. So if you want to check it out, head over to Patreon. The link for that plus everything else I've just mentioned is in the description. Now it's time to welcome back N. Burke for our chat on sociology and villains. I'm delighted to welcome back N. Burke.
Thanks so much for having me back. It's really great to be back.
Oh, yeah. We've had a lot of people asking you to come back on to expand upon our series of how to create characters. And
cool.
It's been fascinating for me as well. So thank you very much. N is the host of 2 podcasts, Cool Story and Rip from the Headlines. Cool Story is all about Wheel of Time, which is one of my favorite fantasy series. But N is also a sociologist and a writer, as well as a broadcaster. And last time they were on the show, we spoke about how sociology contributes in shaping who we are. And that hopefully gave you at home some inspiration for your characters, as well as some useful tips when it comes to creating our fictional people. And I was very keen to get N back on the show for a more in-depth look at characters and villains in particular. So in today's episode, we're going to basically deconstruct deviant characters and criminals and things like that. So, N, take it away.
Yeah, of course. So I think I was kind of starting off just thinking about how to frame what your world decides is deviant behavior. So, you know, sociology is kind of rests on the premise that society is something that we co-create through our definitions of what things mean in the world, and that those definitions are kind of like ever evolving, ever changing through our continued interaction with other people. So in any given context, you're going to have kind of the framing, which is the situation that, you know, any two characters are within. You're going to have the roles that they're playing, which comes along with expectations of what they should be doing within that frame. And then you're going to have leeway, which is kind of like the wiggle room within those roles. So when people go beyond the bounds of that role or have differing opinions on what the framing is or how much leeway should be allowed is when kind of conflict arises and when we determine what behavior is acceptable given our sort of social norms.
Yeah.
So, you know, like for example, in a classroom setting, we would expect the students primarily to be listening, responding to questions that the teacher is asking. We wouldn't expect any of them to like stand on a desk and start singing, or, you know, the teacher to start swearing at the students. You know, those are all things that are outside of the role, outside of the framing of the situation.
Unless you're in Liverpool.
Is that a common student
yeah,
action?
Yeah, that's what my school days were like.
That's awesome.
Maybe less swearing on the teacher's part, but a lot more swearing on the student's part at the teachers.
Listen, I read a study that the more somebody swears, the more like honest and genuine that person is. So.
Thank fuck for that. Eh?
Exactly. So when we, as we're kind of like creating a society, one of the things you're going to have to decide is what is your model for criminal justice? If you're going to be talking about villains or criminals in any way in your society, you have to decide how we kind of police and respond to any sort of crime or deviance in society. Most cultures use a carceral model of crime, meaning that crimes are typically punished. They are often involve the body. So, you know, imprisonment or like public service, giving back to the community is kind of like the carceral model that, you know, you did this bad thing. We are going to punish you for it. And, you know, it's going to involve, you know, prison or jail time or service to the community, often like repayment of fines, things like that. It's rarely built on a model about the wrong about the wrongs being righted.
Yeah.
So that would be more of a restorative justice model where, you know, we would emphasize that the people who create harm in a society would be given the opportunity to engage with the community to make it right. So the idea essentially that, you know, you have your actions are a problem for our community. You as a person are somebody who we want to bring back into our community by healing the things that you did that kind of like violated our norms. And we believe that you should be part of our community, essentially, is kind of the restorative justice model.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons that most societies are kind of based on that carceral model is that there is a very often explicit but also implicit assumption that any crime or deviant acts that are committed are out of a moral failing and not out of necessity.
Yeah.
So if somebody is houseless and they steal food to feed their family, it's society often kind of attributes that to like, why don't you just go get a job? Why don't you go, you know, get unemployment or something? Why are you, you know, going to crime as a way to survive? It's seen as something that like, you're just not working hard enough, or, you know, there's something wrong with your character that you're doing that. It's pretty rare that we look at crime as a symptom of the failings of our society and attribute it more to that individual person.
Yeah.
And one thing I think I'll say about that is I'm from the United States, and the United States is a very, very individualistic culture to our extreme detriment, I think, in a lot of ways. And so we really attribute a lot of folks' actions as, you know, just part of their character and really specific to them. We don't often look at the ways that a society might be failing its people and causing these kinds of actions.
The responses to like these mass shootings is quite revealing of that kind of mentality.
Yeah.
It's like they blame the individual, not the fact that guns are legal and that you can go and buy one if you want.
Yes. Yeah. So you would look, and that actually is a really, really interesting scenario, because there's, I think, a combination of multiple things happening there, right? You've got the access to firearms, which the United States is extremely in defense of.
Yeah.
And then you've also got the kind of lack of mental health awareness, lack of mental health treatment. You've got kind of unchecked, unbridled toxic masculinity. And so all of those things can combine really easily to create those kinds of scenarios, like a mass shooter. There are a lot of things going into that scenario. Of course, you know, this person is also making choices. I'm not excusing the things that they're doing, but there are social elements that contribute to that. So if you're talking about villains, you know, I think it's really worthwhile thinking about not only what are this person's motivations for doing their villainous acts, but what are the ways in which they have been unable to achieve the things that they want through what we would define as legitimate means, yeah. Right?
Definitely, yeah. I think like things like the incel movements.
Yes.
That sort of, that when you said that, then that just reminds me of that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So as I said, most societies look at crime as kind of this moral failing, less often as this result of inequitable access or inequitable opportunities in society. And so rates of crime are going to either really increase or decrease depending upon the pressure that society puts on people to get those good things and the ability to legally accomplish or obtain those things. So the more pressure there is and the less opportunity there is to achieve it, the higher your rate of crime is going to be. So in thinking about your society, you know, as if the economy is failing, if the government is not adequately supporting its citizens, you're just going to see a higher rate of crime, primarily for survival. This, you know, if there's less means to legally accomplish these things, people will commit crime in order to survive. It's just something that we as humans would do.
Yeah.
And with regard to punishment of those behaviors, oftentimes the society is built to this idea that the punishment should be proportional to the crime that is committed. So a perfect example of that, I think, would be life imprisonment or the death penalty for people who commit murders.
Yeah.
So that kind of relationship is also going to be really important. And that will also vary significantly depending on the scale by which your society is sort of more of a like communal socialist democratic company and like a fascist totalitarian society. You're going to see a pretty wide array of punishments. Yeah. So I think for creating kind of a rich world in writing, it's really helpful to think about, you know, who are the folks that are in power defining what these rules are, and defining how we should punish folks in relation to those things that they're kind of violating in society.
Yeah. And if you're looking for inspiration, just look at the medieval period.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
There are some very creative ways of punishing people.
Very. And actually, so that brings me to my next point, which is like, how do we as a society, how do we as people learn what is criminal or deviant? Because almost none of us, you're a lawyer, so you are kind of the exception to this, but most of us do not read the laws. We don't read legal code, but we still learn what we can and can't do for the most part.
Yeah.
And so in older societies, you know, thinking back to like medieval times, for example, punishment for crime was often something that was done publicly, right? You like had floggings in the town square, or somebody was in a pillory for, you know, stealing or whatever it might be. People who were just kind of like the commonplace person would see the punishment and know that they don't want to do those things if they don't want to experience that punishment. So it was that kind of like visual communication of punishment that was the way that most people would learn how not to break the rules of society.
Yeah, it's like a sort of ruling by fear.
Exactly. And today, that would, with like social media and the internet and television, that would look like, you know, televised news or televised court proceedings, I mean to say. So I think like Hester Prynne and The Scarlet Letter is kind of the perfect example of sort of the public punishment that communicates not only to her that she, you know, committed adultery and, you know, has to live with this shame, but to everyone else that this is somebody who is no longer an acceptable part of our society. They've committed this deviant act and we need to shun them, punish them, treat them poorly. But it also tells all of us, okay, if I don't want that, then I need to, you know, prevent myself from committing adultery, things like that.
Yeah.
So kind of thinking about Hester Prynne and these other characters who are sort of shunned from society, whenever folks are sort of labeled as deviant, I think it's also worthwhile to think about how long-lasting that kind of stigma is. You know, so a perfect example in the United States is sex offenders have to be on a sex offender registry. That registry is publicly available. And in most cases, being on that registry is something permanent. Like they are forever labeled as a sex offender.
Yeah.
And so that's a pretty intense stigma. You know, other really permanent examples would be things like branding or, you know, some societies, if somebody steals, their hand is cut off, right? So that punishment is not only proportional, but it's often in some way kind of like connected to the crime that they've committed.
Yeah.
What I've kind of been, you know, leading up to a little bit is that all of this has to do with power, which is something that I kind of talked about, I think, a lot the last time I was here. And I would recommend if folks want a good book to kind of like think about criminal models and just like how society learns the rules around deviance. Michel Foucault wrote a book called Discipline and Punish that talks a lot about kind of the methods of punishment in society and the way that those are communicated. So a lot of what I'm talking about today is kind of touching on his theories and his kind of framework. So if folks want to dive deeper into that, Crime and Deviance by Michel Foucault is a great example of that. Nice. And he talks a lot about power in that because the, you know, I think in smaller societies, it's very communal in how deviant behavior is defined or identified. In larger societies, it is often in the hands of specific people, either, you know, monarchs, if it's a, you know, what's the word I'm looking for?
Aristocrats.
What's the politics called? The type of society where you have a king or a queen? Monarchy. Did monarchy, I yeah. might have actually said
you were
it
right.
at the beginning.
You're right, yeah, you're right. That's what threw me. I was like, oh. If it's not monarchy, what is it?
Yeah. So you know, in a monarchy, you would have this generally one person who has kind of the ultimate power, and you know, they're often seen as ordained by God or, you know, holy in some way. But in larger societies, if you don't have that monarchy where somebody is directing and defining with ultimate power, you'll often have kind of like the elected representatives that are meant to represent the will of the people. Whether that actually happens or not, I will leave up to folks to decide whether that's happening in society today or happens in the worlds that they're creating.
Definitely not in my country.
Same. So what happens is that those people in those kinds of like privileged positions within your society are not only going to determine what is acceptable and what is not, they're going to be deciding those punishments in relation to any sort of deviant act, but they're also going to be the ones who they're also going to apply the rules differently for themselves, right?
Yeah.
So if you are somebody who gets to make the rules and you are breaking them, then you get to kind of decide whether the punishments are applied or not, right? So these, depending on your character's identity, not only might they have sort of differing impacts in relation to crime, but they also are going to have different kind of standards that they're held to whether that behavior is even criminal, right? So, you know, in the United States, we have a lot of corporations who just rob people blind and because our laws are written in such a way, it doesn't, you know, businesses have a lot more leeway in things that they can do, whether they're ethical or not. And these folks who have tons and tons of money and power and influence and fund a lot of our politicians get to decide, you know, oh, we decide that a corporation, it's perfectly legal for them to do this. So, you know, you're going to have really differing definitions of what is deviant, depending upon that character's relation or distance from power in your society.
Yeah. And like you say, the way the society is structured. Mm-hmm. So all these corporations are doing very heinous things, but because the law allows them to.
Yes. Or they can, you know, pay people off and
change the law.
Exactly. To change the law or to look the other way. You know, there's so much. The more, it really comes back to the quote from Spider-Man of with great power comes great responsibility. You know, these people have so much power, and if they aren't really overseen by anyone, are they going to ultimately make benevolent decisions or malevolent decisions?
Self-interest, isn't it? I think that's what we spoke
exactly
with Albie about. And one of the key traits of villains is self-interest.
Yes. Yeah. In Michel Foucault's Crime and Deviance, he has a line that's in Latin, and I'm not going to attempt to say it in Latin, but it's...
Go on, please do it.
I think it's... I'm not even going to try it, but it's who guards the guards, essentially.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that.
And so if you don't have kind of those continued systems of oversight in some way, you will have people who exploit their power in self-interested ways, for sure.
Yeah, it's inevitable, isn't it, really?
I think so, yeah. So thinking about what behavior is determined deviant is going to not only vary depending upon the society's sort of social norms, but it's also going to be kind of specific to that person's identity as well. You know, so if I shot somebody with a gun, I would probably go to prison for murder. If I were a police officer or in the military and literally did the same action, there are going to be very different consequences for that, in part because of the framing, the roles, and the leeway in that situation, right? If it were in self-defense, maybe I would go to prison. You know, there's going to be a lot of kind of determination of what was the framing of the situation, what were the roles in the situation, and how much leeway do we have within those roles.
Yeah.
So if you are, regardless of what kind of model of criminal justice you are going to build for your society, you have to find a way to determine how we're going to surveil it. Like, how are we going to monitor whether people are committing crimes, sort of violating the norms of our society or not? Because the presumption is, if we have enough surveillance, we will be able to stop crime before it happens. In the United States, that often runs counter to sort of the expectations of individual privacy. So part of the reason, another reason that we have so many mass shootings is because in theory, the individuals within the United States have a greater degree of privacy. And so, you know, we don't necessarily know what's going on with every single person's life. So the more privacy that somebody has, the less likely it will be that they will be surveilled and determined to have created a crime or not.
Yeah.
So... kind of implicit within that framework is the assumption that if we are tough on crime, it will decrease the rate of crime. However, that tends to be, the inverse tends to be true. The tougher you are on crime, the higher your crime rate will be. And that's going to be in part due to increased surveillance. You know, in the United States in the 1970s and 1980s, Richard Nixon termed drugs as like enemy number one.
Glad you brought this up, because I don't love it. I absolutely despise the drug war, but I love discussing the impact it's had on society. I blame In this country and any country around the world that has legalized, banned drugs and waged this war, it has fundamentally destroyed so many layers of society and like policing and criminal justice. People, there's a quote from The Wire which sums it up perfectly. If you call something a war, soon enough, everyone's going to call themselves warriors. And then you create this us and them. And The Wire is such a fantastic TV show for exploring this issue in particular, because it shows how hard it is for them to police and to do the job.
Yeah.
So ineffective. Like totally. You say, crime rates going up.
Yeah.
And then they contrast it with like the older generation of the police officers and how they used to police. And it was, it was complete opposites.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. So sorry, I interrupted you there. Carry on.
No. I agree. I think drugs are a particularly really interesting, I think, lens into crime and deviance, in part because drugs are sort of like, they have no discrimination when it comes to identities or, you know, access in society. Like, anybody at any level can be doing drugs, but it's going to, again, have really different impacts on them depending upon sort of their, A, which drug they're using, you know, how much of it they have or they're using, you know, did they impact somebody else through their use? But like I said, when you have somebody define something as kind of like a war, as this sort of like crucial crisis in a society, you're going to have a higher rate of crime relative to that, because you are going to surveil it more intensely. So just by nature of increasing surveillance, you will increase the rate by which you find the crime.
Yeah. I suppose it comes back to this, what you were saying before about it's a means of control, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
And I particularly in the US, I know it's been the drug wars that have been waged for well over 100 years now have all been targeted at different races.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, if you want to look at kind of differential application of punishment relative to drug use, I think the perfect example is the relationship between cocaine and crack. Yeah. And, you know, there are a lot of folks who believe that crack was specifically introduced to the Black community and policed more heavily as a means of control.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of like an interesting avenue to, I think, get into, even if you agree or disagree with kind of either argument there. It's a really telling example of how identity and positions of privilege in society are going to cause you to have different impacts relative to sharing a similar action.
Yeah.
Again, and if you define things as a war, not only are you going to increase surveillance, you're also going to increase the punishment for it. In the United States, we passed what was called the Three Strikes Law, which was essentially that if you committed felony in the United States, if you commit that three times, you are going to jail for the rest of your life. So even if it's just you had an amount of, you know, cocaine or marijuana on you and you were arrested three different times for that, this law now determines that you are going to spend the rest of your life in jail. And this has caused our rate of incarceration to skyrocket. In the past 30 years, our incarceration rate has increased 600%. The United States is the country with the largest percentage of incarcerated people in the world. And even though we are only 5% of the world's population, we are 25% of the incarcerated population in the world. So,
yeah, it also has a private prison system as well, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. So, you know, there is financial motivation for incarcerating people because of the prison industrial complex, which is, you know, the relationship between private business and the jail or prison system. So the idea or the sort of logic behind a carceral prison system is the idea that people commit crimes due to moral failings, not social inequalities, not lack of opportunities. And most of the ways that we punish people are, you know, to give them a record, to put them in jail for a time, you know, to charge them fines, things like that. And the idea is you will go to jail, you will serve your time. It will be a reform. I'm doing air quotes right now. It will reform you.
Yeah.
And after you get out of prison, you have an opportunity to turn your life around. But the problem is, even though the idea is you've paid your debt to society, that record is in a lot of ways a stigma that will further prevent you from legally participating in the requirements and sort of expectations of society, right? So you have a harder time getting a job if you have a record. So the carceral system, solely through the way that it works, actually creates and exacerbates the problems that it says it solves, right?
Yeah, creates a cycle, doesn't it? Because it pushes people down certain avenues of of what they can actually do, which is basically do the same things that got them back in prison in the first place.
Exactly, right. Like if you can't get a job because they're, you know, because your education system failed you, or there's just not enough economic opportunities in your area, like I said, a lot of people will turn to illegal activities to survive. And then if you are caught and go to jail, then you have even fewer potential opportunities in the future to get those sort of like legally, socially acceptable opportunities to survive, to provide for yourself, to provide for your family.
Yeah.
So what a lot of folks think of as recidivism, which is the likelihood that you'll engage in crime after you're released from jail from having committed another crime. You know, a lot of folks look at that as like, oh, this person just can't stay away from, you know, these illegal activities, but don't really look at the ways that the system that we say reforms people and pays their debt to society is actually pushing them into a higher likelihood of engaging in criminal behavior.
Yeah.
Out of necessity.
And I suppose when they're in prison as well, the influence of those around them.
Yes. Yeah. So another really interesting area I would actually love to hear if you bring your psychologist guest back on to talk about this is the prison system, by putting all of the people in one location who have violated the, you know, laws or morals of society, people will learn other ways to violate the norms and, you know, laws of society. They will oftentimes become better at it, less likely to be caught, because they might learn from their own mistakes. They might, you know, learn tricks of the trade from people in jail. And so the sort of socialization that a person receives when they are incarcerated is fascinating, because, you know, I've been talking a lot about sort of like the structural impact to, or the way that structure impacts an individual with relation to criminal justice. But there's definitely a lot of interpersonal, interactional things that happen in jail that will change a person's outlook on the world, will, you know, change what they know about the world, what they believe about the world. So don't discount what prison would do to a person and how that would change their behavior outside of just, you know, whether or not they're violating law in the future.
Yeah. So how would we bring it back then to creating our villain? So I think what we've done is it reminds me a little bit of the recent Joker film, where we start off, we know what the Joker's like, he's a villain. But that film did a fantastic job of going back and looking at all the different things within his life that have led him to become. And I think that kind of feel that's what we've done. We've sort of worked our way backwards, haven't we?
Yeah.
So how can we bring this full circle and back to our characters?
Yeah, I think that again, kind of with relation to your character, if they are writing a villainous character, they are going to have like their driving sort of reason for being a villain is because there are things that they want that they cannot attain through the methods that we expect other people to follow in order to get those things. In some cases, of course, if you've got like, you know, megalomaniacs who are looking to take over the world, that's going to be a little less applicable. But yeah. Villains are always looking for something that they think they can't get other ways. Or, you know, they want them faster, or they don't want to have to do all the work that it takes to get there. And so I think thinking about what are the impediments to that person getting the things that they want is going to have a huge influence on how that person behaves, what methods they are going to use, and think about all of the sort of social factors that tell this person you are not, you know, you're not good enough, or you're not in a social position to achieve these things, create a really big tension between what this person wants and how and whether or not they can get it. Because that's going to really shape how far they are willing to go to get that thing.
Yeah. And I suppose it addressing your weaknesses as well, and like surrounding yourself with people who can do the things that you can't. I mean, one example that just sprung to my mind when you were talking there, Cersei Lannister and the Mountain, when she sort of, whatever the hell goes on with him.
Turns him into a zombie or whatever.
Yeah, but then he becomes her physical strength, essentially. Yeah. And so it's like surrounding yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
With these kind of people,
or even, I mean, as much as people hated the final season of Game of Thrones, I think, you know, taking every character that Dany had any sort of relationship with and taking them away from her, killing them.
Yeah.
She really has, there is no connection between her and any of these people around her anymore. And so that's in theory kind of why she, you know, starts having the dragon blow fire on them. So the other element I think that's really worth thinking about in creating a villain is their social network. Again, if somebody has fewer social connections, they are probably more likely to engage in crime because, you know, it's not going to bring shame on the family, or it's, you know, they don't have somebody they can go to stay with while they can't afford to pay rent. So how much of a support system this person has is also going to have a big impact on how far they'll go to get the things they want.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I suppose that the people do make a lot of connections, don't they, between upbringing and the influences that you have at that age, don't they? Is there how much weight should writers ascribe to like the upbringings and parents?
Yeah, I think that often peer groups tend to be more influential than families, than parental influence. Up to, you know, up till like we start going to, you know, public school or private school, whatever, our parents and our families are going to have the greatest influence. But after that, we tend to be much more influenced by our peers than our family. But a person's ability to achieve things in their life are often heavily influenced by kind of the social location of their parents and family. So if their family doesn't have a lot of network connections, doesn't have a lot of economic opportunities, this person is much more likely to also not have those things or not be able to obtain those things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. It's very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like the butterfly effect, isn't it?
Very much. Yeah. There's so many elements at play. And I think that's, you know, the fun of writing a character is you get to decide what all of those elements are that are going to shape the decisions that they make and who they are as a person.
And thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. Yeah, absolutely fascinating as always. Have you got any recommended reading or resources that people could go and check out if they wanted to learn a bit more about this subject?
Yeah, so I mentioned Michel Foucault's Crime and Deviance. I think there are some really interesting readings that talk about The impact of the carceral system on communities. I think just Googling anything about crack and cocaine in the United States will give you a lot of insight into that.
Definitely. On that point as well, I'll recommend the film, The House I Live In.
Oh, yeah. It's
a fantastic film.
Been a while since I've seen that, but definitely, I think that's a good recommendation.
Yeah, that's just basically chronicles the whole war on drugs in America, doesn't it, really? And the impact with the societal deterioration it's had on a lot of people. And David Simon, the creator of The Wire, he features a lot in that one. So,
yeah. And I think from a fictional standpoint, even though I did not like this book, controversial opinion maybe, Crime and Punishment is, I think, a really great example of somebody who is struggling with getting access to the things that they want in legitimate means in society. So that I think is a really great fictional example of how that might impact a character. But if folks are interested in this and they want more recommendations, they are more than welcome to email me, and I will happily give them any kind of suggestions in any particular area that might be of interest to them. Oh,
that's very kind of you. What's the best place to get in touch then?
So you could email me through either of my podcast emails, which is coolstorypod@gmail.com or rippedheadlines@gmail.com. Or my individual email is nburke, E-N-N-B-U-R-K-E, @gmail.com. So anybody who wants more answers, more information, has any questions, I'm more than happy to talk to anyone.
Oh, thank you so much, Jen. And hopefully, if you're interested, you'd like to come back on. Because I don't feel we've only just scratched the surface.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything, anytime, I'm happy to come back.
Thank you very much. And thank you, everyone, for listening. A massive thank you to N. I really do hope you learned something new there. I found it a really interesting, fascinating chat. And when I was editing it, going back, listening again, I thought it was even more interesting. So hopefully you've got some inspiration and ideas, not only just for your villains, but for your world building as well, because you can begin to see how related everything is with society and your characters. And it's really important, I suppose, to keep in mind this cause and effect principle, that if you're going to create something in your world, what is the effect of that? And how is that going to shape society and the people that live within it? And you never know, you might find some really, really interesting ideas when you start to explore these little what ifs. So thanks again, En. And they will be back in future episodes to chat more about sociology of different characters. And if you have any requests for topics, or if you'd like any other guests that we've had on, no doubt they will be returned in future episodes. But if you've got any specific requests, please do write in to us. Our email address is thefantasywriterstoolshed@gmail.com. You can also message us on Instagram. Again, just search for the name of the podcast. And don't forget, if you don't want to miss any future episodes, be sure to subscribe or follow. And if you really like what we do, a quick rating on Spotify or on iTunes or any other platforms would be amazing. It's a great way for you to show your support and for us to grow as a show, and to help even more people with the writing, to help us achieve that even more. So a quick share on social media or with anyone you know who you think may be interested would be a huge help too. Thank you very much if you do that. If you'd like to get more help with your writing, or if you'd like to connect with other people, like-minded people, join our writing group. And we are very active on Discord at the moment. We've got loads of different threads going on, loads of different chats, and a lot of people getting really good help and advice. And it's nice to see people getting success with short story submissions as well, particularly off the back of things that have gone on, like working with other writers and stuff in the writing group. So it's definitely helping people. And if that's what you're looking for too, get involved. It's open to everybody. If you'd like to keep on learning, head over to Patreon and look at all our new tiers, where you can find workshops and writing classes on writing fantasy, like how to write a fantasy novel, how to edit a novel, how to build a world, and even ones on book marketing. So you can find stuff on how to set up your website, how to write content that ranks on Google, and how to set up your email marketing system. We'll be back on the 14th of September. So thank you very much for listening. And until then, keep on scribbling.